Welcome to the Cybersecurity and Cloud Podcast, the podcast where we learn from cybersecurity experts how to stay safe, private, and secure on the cloud and in code. CSCP is hosted by Francesco Cipollone, your cybersecurity friend with a passion for all things cyber and sharing stories of other professionals with you. This episode is brought to you by the generosity of Phoenix Security Limited. Phoenix helps startups and enterprises solve complex software security supply chain visibility by leveraging the power of correlation and contextualization. Discover how Phoenix Security helps CISO and security engineers act fast, prevent burnout, and implement DevSecOps at the speed of cloud. Phoenix Security. Correlate, contextualize, and act on risk with one click. Let's dive in.
Welcome back to the Cybersecurity and Cloud Podcast. Today, we're going to talk about a topic that traditionally we never talked about. And I have a good friend that we exchange very fiery debates. So today is going to be fun. So I have on the show today, Raj Umadas, a good friend, head of InfoDex at ActBlue. But we know each other from various groups and various fiery discussion about application security. But without further ado, Raj, welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit more about you.
Hey, Frank, looking forward to this conversation. As you said, we definitely had some fiery other conversation in other circles. So this is going to be a good one. Like you said, my name is Raj. I run InfoSec over at ActBlue. And like just a quick thing about me and how I got into the space. When I was in high school, I went to a vocational high school and I learned networking. Right out of high school, I got my CCNA and I told my mom and dad, hey, I don't need to go to college. I'm just going to go be a network admin, get my CCIE, do the Cisco thing. Life will be great. And my mom and dad were like, well, get out the house. I'm like, damn, can't afford that. So let me go to college being like the studious sort of West Indian that I am. Went to university, did my comp sci degree. Initially, it was like the first time I wrote a single line of code was an undergrad at university. I was not one of these InfoSec people who got into it in high school or early. I started to play with software development in university. And for the first couple of years, I started to go deeper and deeper down the stack, like, you know, intro programming, went into digital logic, computer architecture. I was like, whoa, this is really cool. Software is not what a computer is. The hardware is what the computer is. So I transitioned to computer engineering and just kept on going deeper and deeper, doing more architecture classes, doing VLSI layouts, doing just ASIC design. And I was like, whoa, this is really, really cool. I can like
when ASIC layout was still a thing.
Well, ASICs. I mean, ASICs are still around. Like everything Apple right now is all their custom chips. But as I was going through this journey at university, I was still my last semester. I didn't know what I needed to do in my life. I just knew I liked digital things. And I did a couple of internships. And it wasn't until my last semester I took my first security elective. So keep in mind, I went through all my undergrad, nothing security just yet, just software engineering, networking, and hardware design. Took my first security elective, and I met a lot of security professionals in the New York City area. And I was like, okay, wow. I get it now. I know how to write software. I know how to do hardware. I know how to lay out a network. I could just break the whole thing. So I tricked this small little boutique firm in New York to give me an internship to do mobile application security. This is pre-Android and iOS. So this is on like feature phones.
You start really hard.
Yeah. And then I got there. I was at this place called Intrepid Group for a couple of years. And I just learned security on the job, essentially being a pen tester. After a couple of years of pen testing, many years of pen testing, I decided to go on the blue side. I was lucky to be able to join like organizations that kind of were pioneering SecDevOps principles, Etsy, Spotify being some of those. And again, learning on the job, just how to break things, but always going back to my first principle knowledge of understanding how things were made. And like, that's how I got into security. That's how I'm still in security.
No, that's really amazing. And that's one of my pet peeves. Do everybody in AppSec needs to come from breaking stuff or traditional background of pen tester, or can they come from the blue team and then learn how to break? Like, which angle is actually more, in your experience, more fundamentally correct or incorrect, if we can even say something like this in security?
I have opinions on this. So over the past 4 or 5 years, I've had to build out AppSec teams, or generally I would call them platform security teams, where I'm working at these past organizations, where it's teams that need to support software engineers in a very typical sense, as well as infrastructure engineers. So people who are going to write code, write Node, write, let's say, Angular front ends, as well as write Terraform to deploy the infrastructure. We build teams to support those individuals. And historically, early in my team building sort of career, I would tend towards the pen tester. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think it was because I was lazy. Me tending towards a pen tester allowed me to connect with that individual more quickly because that was my history. And one thing that you learn very early on when building teams is it's easy to be lazy and hire people that are like you. And it's hard not to do that. And I would say over my journey of understanding that you need to cast a wide net to build diverse teams, mm-hmm. you start to realize some of the lack of diversity is this dimension here, hiring people that have similar sort of work histories. And right. as soon as I realized that was a problem in my hiring, it was amazing. I decided, hey, the next couple of hires, no pen testing background, but they needed to have some background that could support the stakeholder. Mm-hmm. So how do we support our stakeholders? Well, thinking offensively is one of those skills. We, as a security team, when we build out our teams, we have to think offensively to prioritize the work. But right. we also need to know how do our stakeholders do their work. Finding people who have been builders in the past gives you a head start on that. They understand the contention and the pressure between a product manager and an engineering manager and a stakeholder security team. They're able to communicate with those people very quickly, and they build mm-hmm. trust very quickly. So if you understand that when you're hiring a person, let's say that's not from the pen testing background, it's from the other side, then what is it that they bring to the table immediately? It's that empathy and it's that trust building. So make sure you verify that and then teach them the offensive side. And we're lucky where we live right now, when we live right now, bug bounties being super popular. There's tons of content out there right. to get your basic understanding of AppSec in like the areas I work on. So to sum it up, it's not necessarily one is inherently better than the other, being coming from, let's say, a pen testing side versus coming from a building side, but it's more so understanding when you're building your team, what's your expectations day one from a pen tester versus a builder, and then what's your support need to be. If you're for the pen tester, I knew I needed to do this because I always did it, but I always had to support them initially on being empathetic and not, yeah, on the communication side. You do not have to do that from the builder side as rigidly as you had from a pen tester side.
Right. And you have the two different mindset of attacker, and everything is breakable and critical, and you don't have the same mindset from a builder where, okay, let's prioritize, let's discuss, let's evaluate, but then you don't have the offensive. So I like the chemistry and mix that you create to actually create a very chemical team, but also you mm-hmm. need to bridge your own stereotype, because traditionally we come from either pen testing or blue team, and even development, if we're lucky, we come from development, and not a lot mm-hmm. of CISO actually come from that background. I had an interesting conversation last week on that. So maybe we can approach that on, like, what the heck is a product?
What is, like, a
we
product?
Talk about that product is security a lot right now, because mm-hmm. AppSec is boring, and calling yep. it AppSec is becoming boring. But what it is a product, like, because everybody seems to have a different, completely wildly different opinion. And you mentioned yep. two or three things that are interesting in defining what a modern product is, but it's very different how a traditional organization thinks and a modern DevOps shop thinks product.
Yep. So I can explain it from, like, my experiences. Mm-hmm. A product in most places I work in, which tends to be pre-public organizations going through a hyperscale sort of growth because they're still acquiring a market, they're acquiring a customer. So most, if this resonates with you, a product is the thing that that organization will expend resources on to acquire the most mm-hmm. amount of customers, acquire the most amount of revenue. In the most sort of purest of sense, that's what a product is. Some person in leadership decides we're going to spend money, spend marketing dollars, spend headcount budget, spend salary, spend vendor budget to do a thing, because in a couple of months, that thing is probably going to get 10,000 more customers in, or $10,000 more of revenue. So that's what I think about when I think product. Now, the reason I describe it like that is because when you have a product security team at a technology organization, you will tend to support technology solutions to that problem. Mm-hmm. Hey, we are going to turn this feature on. We're going to tweak this user experience and provide this new flow through some website or provide this new capability through some API because the market researchers decided there existed a customer that we didn't service well. So by enabling this API to take this extra parameter to integrate with this new, let's say, municipality to make this new regulation work, that will be the product that you implement. And a product security team's job is to figure out who ideates that solution, who's going to be responsible for implementing that solution, and then supporting those people to make sure when they do it, an evil outsider or maybe an evil insider can't take advantage of that new thing, that change in the world. But I want to also say this. Sometimes, let's say you're working at a real estate brokerage that is technology enabled, as I did in the past. Sometimes a product is not that technologically driven. Sometimes in a real estate brokerage, you need to make sure that a person, a broker who is getting emails from everywhere is not as likely to have a business email compromise affect them because brokers often are targeted for wire fraud type attacks or tricking them to send money to different places. So a product in that world could be something that the financial operators or the compliance operators are taught. Hey, before you close a deal, make sure you do this checklist. And the product there is the creation of a checklist. So now if you have a product security team in a brokerage, do you ignore that and just say, hey, that's legal's job. Legal's job is going to be to review that checklist. Or as a product security person at that organization, you realize, going back to the pen testing concept here, your primary function of the organization is to be the evil thinker and to think about how changes in technology or process can lead to an evil person doing evil things. And then how do you tweak those things to make it less likely? At this real estate brokerage, those sorts of things would come into the security team and we would have conversations. This is the avenue that leads to this new social engineering attack. This is a technology solution perhaps that can solve for that. This is a regex that you would put out in like an email filter that will particularly detect for these sort of like compromises. So to sum it all up, a product is very much tied to the organization you exist in, what you think the organization does to acquire more revenue, acquire more customers, especially if you're in a growth phase, that's the product. And if you have a product security team, I would argue it is your job to understand how to help those decision makers make those decisions and implement those decisions in ways that make it less likely for those who are going to attack you to take advantage of you.
This episode is brought to you by the generosity of Phoenix Security Limited. Phoenix helps startups and enterprises solve complex software security supply chain visibility by leveraging the power of correlation and contextualization. Phoenix platform connects to your repositories, scanners, and cloud, correlates all the information, and provides you with a prioritized list of vulnerabilities that need to be addressed first. Discover how Phoenix Security helps CISOs and developers remove friction and maximize the use of DevSecOps professionals at phoenix.security. Phoenix Security, correlate, contextualize, and act on risk with one click.
I'm going to ask, as always, fictitious question. How hard is to explain to a pen tester the concept of risk and product and different level of managing those things? And even more harder on like how hard, well, maybe from a blue team, a blue teamer is more used to, as you say, the way to build things, maybe that there are owner and responsible people and that things might not always get fixed.
Yeah,
and that's fine.
Yep. Maybe I'll piss off some people saying this, but I would say it's near impossible. Let's take the extreme sense. It's near impossible for me, as in a person who owns the risk posture of my organization, let's say, to explain to a penetration testing shop that risk posture in a way where we would see it the same way. We would make the same calls. For many reasons. One reason is that that penetration tester, that organization, they don't have the history of my organization. They don't have enough time to understand all of the compensating controls. And it would take a lot more time for me to explain all those compensating controls during a scoping call, during some SOW work, during some MSA work. where it's not important. I do not need to do that. And I don't think they need to do it either. Realistically, when I want to work with a pen tester, it's because I need to do some sort of verification of my protective controls. And I want them to just think about that. So what I would do is I would explain to most of my pen testing like partners, this is the area that we've been working on. These are some of the protective controls in our stack. This is what we have in our WAP that's unique. This is what we have in some of the middleware that implements auth N and auth Z that's unique. These are a couple of the features that we rolled out in the past, like, year. I would like you to represent these five user classes across this area. Here's all the code and that stuff. Here is where I think we're, you know, protecting. Mm-hmm. Please have at it. And like, that's it. And their goal is to hopefully find places where my assumptions are incorrect. And that was really good. And if they help me understand how to remediate those things because they have a general idea on like what the remediations for each individual pathway looks like, that's also good. But if, and then when they have to give me a risk rating, they can try their best to give me a risk rating for what they know, but I don't need them to give me the ultimate risk rating. And like, I'll even go so far as saying this thing. I was a pen tester for probably like 6 or 7 years at a small shop and independent for a little while. And then I went to Etsy and Squarespace and Spotify over like those years after pen testing. Mm-hmm. It probably took me like 4 years. I remember distinctly thinking to myself when I first started Etsy, wow, we only spend like 10% of our entire budget on pen testing. Why don't we spend 50% of our budget on pen testing, like person who runs our security team? Why aren't we just testing all the time? And it took me years to get the experience to understand like what is feasible in terms of acquiring budget, maintaining budget, what is feasible in terms of like when you find everything, you can't fix everything. So find enough that you can fix. Like these concepts that you just pick up over the years of having to spend the money, employ the people, partner with your stakeholders on all the side, that you zero in on this sort of balance. And a pen testing person wouldn't have spent that time, nor should they, I think.
So it takes a little while to get their mindsets from the opposite way. And I really like how you painted the picture of like, I don't want a pen tester to understand my risk profile because he never will. And there is a lot of debate around, oh, but a pen tester always rate things very, very high. And then a lot of CISOs that are frustrated, the high is a high and it's taken in that way. And it's not contextualized in where you are. So it's taking pen testing and pen testing result with a grain of salt. But I really like the fact that you admittedly say that it's a whole mental process of getting adapted to where you are and where the product is and where the organization is and what battle can you win and what battle you will need to drop.
Exactly.
So
something you brought up that I think is interesting I wanted to highlight is there definitely exist situations where a CISO will read a pen testing report and get anxious very quickly because they see five highs. And it's probably the case that the CISO at some organizations weren't involved with the pen test at all because they had their product security team or their AppSec team manage this exercise. And the CISO only sees the report at the very end because they decided to invite themselves to the closeout meeting without any of the background understanding of what was going on or the agenda or the objectives. And I would say if that is the case and you find yourself as a AppSec, ProdSec leader, having an anxious CISO flip out over a pen test report, there's probably blame to go around all over the place. One potential blame I would say is as a person who would be responsible for executing the pen test, realizing that your budget owner, the CISO, is the one that ultimately pays for this task, you should ensure that they understand what's going on. It is part of our job as, let's say, focused security leaders in a certain domain to make sure that the security budget owner has the understanding of what the strategy is and what the goals are. And if your CISO becomes anxious and you're not anxious, there was probably some communication gap that could have been solved by you, let's say. I would also dare say I love working in organizations that have rather technical CISOs. So CISOs that do not have a problem getting into the weeds, CISO who may have come up through the side of the house that would understand a pen test report, would understand like some of these findings and how they get rated the way they get rated and can lead to fun conversations.
They're rare.
They are rare. And it's a good thing that we have the ability of deciding where to work. So we interview our boss as much as they interview us, is what I would say to anyone that listening in on this podcast.
But it's actually, you brought in a good point in there, that is, a lot of CISO actually don't come from, well, let's say infrastructure. They traditionally come from infrastructure background. And we were discussing with a few friends that not a lot of them come from DevOps shops and DevSecOps, and none of them understand the whole process of, like, why don't you don't just patch, or why don't you just upgrade their libraries? Like, there seems to be a whole view of vulnerability problems, regardless of where they come, that they can be just tick in the box, fixed. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why, as security professional in AppSec, we had such a hard time getting the DevSecOps mentality, that it's not just patch it. What mm-hmm. do you think about?
Yes. So the DevSecOps mentality is probably something that has been, for me, something I could put a finger on around the 2010 sort of year. That's what I started to feel. I think it was a thing, at least I was perceiving. That being said, it was still pretty early in my career, so maybe it existed before, but I wasn't mature enough to see it. But I would say from about 2013 is when I started to understand what this could be. And it wasn't even DevSecOps at the time. It was very much DevOps at the time. And it came from a place where, historically speaking, I think the decade before, software would be written, put onto a DVD or a CD, be shipped out, and that is like the bulk of it. And things that were like web enabled, it was still pretty fresh, feel pretty new, and like patching on that and iterating on that. I want to imagine, I wasn't there for this, but I would guess the early web developers were still developing like CDs. They would make a thing, they would deploy it out there, they'd put it on a domain, put it on a server, and move and do another thing. So
it's very versioning.
It was heavily versioned. And so probably around the time I got into insecurity is when people started to realize, no, software is this living thing. And because it's living, it needs to get nurtured. So we needed to now start to figure out how to move people who already have jobs, right? So like mm-hmm. we're in a place where you have people who are writing software, and we have people who were like racking and stacking hardware, and you have people who were patching and having a beeper and like making sure that they can like restart things. And you had to redeploy all these people to figure out like, how do we make the job work better? So now around 2013 is when we started to realize, okay, software is a living thing, and we needed to, and the product that is technology backed is the living thing. So how do we make sure it stays alive? And how is it staying alive? Well, we're going to get these things where we need to make servers upgrade themselves without downtime. We're going to have to patch software and change the rules in the on the fly and have two versions of like code running at the same time. And like, you started realizing that some of the skills needed on the ops side, yeah, were existing on the software side, but some of the software skills didn't support the software engineers to support the infrastructure. So the band-aid was get unicorns, get people who can do it all, or build teams who theoretically could do it all, but still the atomic deliverer of value is a human. So if you have a team of software engineers and infrastructure engineers, that doesn't necessarily mean they can do DevOps well. So mm-hmm. then what was happening was the supporting infrastructure and the supporting frameworks started to come in and fix the problems, right? So we started to get things like the cloud push, and we started getting frameworks like, let's say, Rails, that would try to make things more ambiguous. And like, that's when like ORMs were like more popular in my brain. So now you had like software trying to do infrastructure, but then what you ended up having there is all this inefficiency and extra CPU cycles like
just being spun up to patch.
Exactly. So now like you're having this world that's sort of like trying to find a solution to this. Again, what's the problem? Software and product started to become a living thing that needed nurturing. And we are still in this phase, I think, right now, where we're trying to figure out how can we as human beings who are building product nurture this thing that is like software in the internet. And what where we're kind of coming to is this idea of Sec DevOps, where individuals have to have some ability to nurture on all sides of this. And we are going to augment those individuals' capabilities via the correct set of tools and frameworks. Kubernetes, AWS, shared responsibility matrix, modern frameworks that are memory safe, and we will deploy these things. And then I'm sure I'm not as familiar with this, but the management principles and how you measure the productivity and how you measure the output, those fields I'm sure are advancing in similar ways where, for what it's worth, things don't go down as often as they would in the past. Like a couple of years ago when Facebook went down for like those couple of hours, it was so astonishing, like so astonishing. But think about like,
DNS.
And it's always DNS. And if it's not DNS, it's caching. It's always DNS or it's caching. But when these things are happening, when these things are happening more recently, we are that much more astonished. But consider how much more complex the world has gotten. So the complexity is increasing like orders and orders and orders of magnitude. But our expectations on reliability and robustness are also increasing just as fast, and things are maintaining themselves there. And I forget exactly where this question landed, but I'll say this to bring it back. Getting people to understand what we just talked about, we are lucky because we grew up in it. Like we grew up in it. It's very similar to like the generation that was old enough to not have a cell phone and then to have a cell phone. We get to appreciate sort of like what it was like to leave your house and not have anyone be able to communicate with you. And now we are lucky because we, I think, have grown in our career during the Sec DevOps transition. So lots of us get to innately understand it. Sometimes there are people who we're reporting into, let's say, that they were around for it, but they were way far out of the implementation to appreciate as much as us. Or we have people who are just getting into the industry who have different understandings, different expectations because they started in it. And we are bridging like this sort of gap where like people are starting with, well, obviously everything should be serverless, to no, everything exists on a server. And we're in this middle trying to like do this sort of translation. And that's part of our job, I think. If we start to realize... that's our
and
job.
And actually, on that point, you bring in a very good point that we understand, like me and you grow on understanding what hardware is. Like a lot of modern workforce and a lot of guys that actually come out on understanding DevOps, they're just built in the cloud. Like it's cloud native, and cloud is this fluffy thing that is somebody else's computer, and network is still out there, DNS are still out there. Like those service layer are kind of guaranteed and almost become invisible, and it's just throwing code at something. Don't you think that we're going to get to a point where, okay, we built an abstraction layer that is so good, but we actually made ourselves dumber because there will be attack path and attack vectors that could come from things that we take for granted, like the whole software lifecycle. We took it for granted, the whole digital supply chain, we took it for granted that people were secure by default. Software was shipped secure by default, and it was somebody else's problem. And then we had Colonial Pipeline, then we had SolarWind, then we had Log4j, then we had like, I don't know, a sequence of gotcha and aha moments around the software part that like
software. So before you get too far from that, would you add to that list you just said the various MMU bugs that were detected in Intel chips as a similar gotcha? The supply chain of our processor was not targeted, let's say, but it led to a failure. Would you put that in the same category as SolarWinds?
I don't necessarily. Yes and no. I think we got a wake-up call with Spectre and Meltdown that there was some issue on the chip line. I think it didn't resonate as much in terms of magnitude, and maybe because we have PTSD out of OpenSSL strut that actually caused that ripple effect. And Log4j, Spring for Shell, all this new kind of category of vulnerability, I think resonated from a fear factor perspective. I have to say that the chip attack and the hardware attack and all the IoT that comes from it, I think it went a little bit under the radar because we kind of took this for granted that hardware is secure by default, and it actually is not.
But... okay, and now let me add some more nuance to this. I would say, if you look at the budgets for a design and feature engineer to test engineer in the hardware world, it's very interesting. Like at one point, it would be like one builder of hardware to five testers of hardware. And that was the norm. That was expected, like Intel and AMD's budget, NVIDIA's budget. they have to heavily invest in test verification because of many reasons. Some of them are economic in nature. Once you lay this thing out and you build like billions of these things, patch them. So like the economics of the situation kind of motivated this. Part of this also was potentially motivated by the fact that as a society, we expect more correctness in this side of the game. So because we expect more correctness, we invest in more correctness, and we are somewhat surprised when like it fails with Spectre, for example, but yeah, we're not as like, we don't feel as bad about it. It's like, oh, we tried our best, shit. But we're feeling more bad about when some of the software ones start to fall over. And it's possibly because...
I disagree on that. I think we expect the software to be much more fragile than the hardware. Like if your laptop fails, you feel outraged. But if a web page gave you a 404, it's like, yeah, the software. I feel that we got used to, like, really one point really resonated with me, that is the level of rigidity and due diligence. And I had the pleasure to discuss with some of the guys in the Navy, in the military background, the way they build software is very strict with very strict version. And maybe that's not the most agile way, but that's the most secure way. Security require rigor, discipline, a lot of testing. And I think we lost a little bit of that rigor in the light of speed that we want to develop. There wasn't the principle of DevOps, but it kind of the byproduct of DevOps that we kind of misread speed for kind of rubbish in, rubbish out. And the fact that, as you rightfully said, once you build a piece of hardware, you assume that that's going to be deployed under the sea and you're not going to be able to patch it in a very quick way. So you better build it on the X amount of use cases. The fact that we got used to an SDLC pipeline where tomorrow I can develop the patch, the code, well, actually, that's not really true. How many times you can deploy a critical patch, like what happened to Datadog the other day, automatically and take down the system, there needs to be careful consideration. Now, that doesn't happen that frequently, but, and that's my fictitious...
to bring it back then, is like the question could potentially be, is this a good or a bad thing that software trended in this direction? That's one. Also, remember, we were talking about like this idea a little bit ago around the cloud abstracting away from builders so much things that are still required for it to operate. Is that necessarily a good or a bad thing? Like both of these things potentially are related. What motivates these directions? I'm like, I want to say economics. I want to say it is to the masses that are spending their money and investing their time and labor into stuff. This is where we've decided to go, that we're okay with this level of fragility for speed. And why are we okay with that? Because the presumption is growth and advancement. The presumption is you need this speed to get the next step, the next phase, the next discovery. And without this speed, someone else will do it. Or without this speed, no one will do it.
But don't you think as an organization, we will always be full speed right now? That we got the free for all, like hardware got heavily regulated. Software didn't get so heavily regulated. So we kind of, a software tech company, we got the free for all, go at the speed of light, invent the next word. And now we're suffering from the post effect of a speed for the sake of speed that brought a lot of innovation, but also a vacuum in regulation. And I think with the Colonial Pipeline, with SolarWind, or with different kind of gotcha, kind of the government start realizing, actually, we need to regulate software a little bit more, because otherwise...
I'm feeling proud about that. Like with GDPR and privacy being like the thing from a couple of years ago, and how that kicked off just like lots of various regulatory bodies and municipalities starting to do similar things. That felt like a correct correction and something that's trending in a good way. And over these last year and a half, the White House, I think it's CISA, like these agencies in America, they're starting now to have opinions on third-party software management. They're starting to have stronger opinions on safe software development practices. And what it makes me happy is when I'm looking at the groups who are commenting on it, when I'm looking at the people who are speaking about it, it does look like it is being sourced from industry leaders, not yes. just existing in some small room in some government building, but it's out there in the world of people that we all work with. So it does look like, although lagging, presumably it has to be lagging, we are catching up to the needed regulatory frameworks to help us as software engineers and security engineers build things fast enough, but safer than we have in the past, and learning from some of those mistakes. And I will say this, it is our job to have these conversations, inject ourselves in those conversations, provide those pieces of information and feedback, because that's the way, like, the things that we want to get done will outlast us.
Yeah, and it's our duty, actually. I will even say even heavier to actually be in some of this conversation. But anyway, we can discuss this about for ages, and, you know, I get lost discussing with you on this. But unfortunately, we are coming towards the end of the show. But we have a tradition, Raj, that is I think we kind of closing on a positive note. What would be your closing message, your closing positive message for the show?
Yeah. My positive message is, much like we have already seen in the past, progress will not stop. We will, as a group of individuals and a world, build cooler things, build it faster, build it better, solve problems we have no idea about, which makes me feel that we as security professionals who have to help those things, those products be safe, we have lots of fun ahead of us, but we have to make sure that we're doing it because we want to make the thing safer and be partners with those who are building, and not be those that are holding back those that are building. And I am very excited as I'm building out the teams and working with the people that I'm working with, that I'm seeing this idea of partnership coming more to the forefront, seeing this idea of builders wanting to think about privacy a little bit more first, thinking about the attack paths a little bit more first. And as long as we can meet those software engineers and those builders where they want to be, we will be able to do really good stuff, build really good stuff. And now, especially how we were just saying, those other partners now include governments and regulatory bodies and the politicians who are helping shape our society. So let's also make sure we don't forget that we can play in those spaces as well, and we should.
And I think that's a wonderful message to close the show, saying we have the speed, we have the power, now we need to use it for good.
Yep, yep.
And we have the chance. Like, I think we are at the singularity element, at the singularity time where this thing can really happen and we can really make the difference. And if this doesn't happen, so anyway, for everybody out there, go out there, make the change, work with your business, is work at the speed of business.
Yes, yes, yes.
Raj, thank you so much for coming on the show. These conversations are always super pleasurable, and I hope everybody else enjoy the show. So go out there, make the work happen, and stay safe. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please leave us a review on Apple Podcast and post it on social media tagging Cybersecurity Cloud Podcast for a chance to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Discover other episodes at www.cybersecuritypodcast.com.